Good morning. Be seated, please. Justice Stratton is not able to be with us in oral arguments this morning, but she's read the briefs. We tape all oral arguments, and so she will be participating in the decisions in the cases. The first case is 591, State of Ohio versus Clifton Hill. Mr. Marks.
Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, may it please the Court, first I would like to reserve approximately 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
I am the first Assistant Prosecuting Attorney in Fairfield County. Approximately May of 1996, the Fairfield County Common Police Court instituted a local rule providing for routine use of anonymous juries in all civil and criminal cases.
Was the adoption of this rule, I take it there was some study before the adoption of the rule. Were you a participant in that?
The record does not reveal what study was done. Our office was not a participant in the study. There is some record discussion when Judge Clark instructed the court about the thought process. But because of the unusual way that this case is proceeding to this court, we don't really have the development of the trial court record that we need.
Our attorneys provided generally questionnaires that are filled out by jurors with their names, addresses on them, and other information. Our attorneys provided routinely with these questionnaires so that they do, in fact, know the names of the prospective jurors.
Again, it's not really clearly part of the record, but actually back then, they had everything but the names and addresses.
Okay, so they never, the jurors are always known by a number and not by a name.
Correct. And the jury is instructed, this is the routine practice used in every kind of case. And we argue that manner is less onerous than the federal court manner, where they first must hold a hearing, decide that the person is of such a threat that we have to keep the jury anonymous. Then the jury knows this is a bad man, we better be careful. Whereas in the system adopted in Fairfield County, they are told this is what we do in every single case. Of even more import is the fact that the local rule did provide a mechanism where any party that claimed that they were aggrieved could request a hearing, and for good cause shown, could receive the names of the jurors. There's nothing in the records to indicate the trial counsel for Mr. Hill wanted to know the names of the jurors. In fact, if the voir dire is viewed carefully, one of the jurors mentioned that her daughter was in trouble with juvenile court. There was a tremendous amount of openness provided, and even though there are law review articles and some of the case law suspects that the juror, arguably the jurors may be less than frank if they're anonymous, the record in this case belies that. One of the jurors is a very close personal friend of Mr. Rogers. Since no one knew her name, no one would necessarily know that, but she brought it up. And the Common Police Court of Fairfield County determined that this was a better procedure to follow.
Whether this is proper or not, are you arguing waiver?
Yes, we're arguing waiver. We're also arguing that there is no miscarriage of justice. There's equal fairness to both sides. In fact, we argue that the prosecution is more disadvantaged than the defense because they're, hopefully, if Mr. Landfeld and I are doing our jobs right, we have angered more people than defense counsel usually do.
So both sides are prejudiced, so it's okay.
If the sides are prejudiced, they're prejudiced equally. Correct. And that does make it fair.
But, of course, the Fifth District held this to be structural error, which waiver is irrelevant to structural error.
Waiver is irrelevant to structural error, but the error must be plain, and there must be a miscarriage of justice. And this is different than the cases where judges' own financial wherewithal were dependent on the verdict or blacks were systematically excluded from the grand jury, and the judge deciding that motion was the very judge that had excluded them. Structural error is very rarely used in this country's history, and only to correct a manifest injustice, and that is what did not happen in this case.
There doesn't seem to be any other state or indeed court that has adopted, permitted this policy to be adopted. Why should we be an exception to the general rule, both federal courts and state courts, as I read the briefs?
It is not really clear. I don't know that because there was no trial court record, it is not certain that there are not other jurisdictions that have done this too. Certainly there have been anonymous juries throughout the country. The difference, of course, is that this was routine use. But again, either party had the option to request the names and addresses of the jury. And there's certainly nothing from this record that shows that Mr. Hill wanted to know the names of the jurors. In almost all the structural error cases, one of the parties objected to the court's procedure. We have to give trial courts an opportunity to remedy errors if there is an error.
Was there anything in the record that demonstrates, if there is such a request, how that is handled?
Yes. The local rule itself says that there is a hearing, and that each party is given an opportunity to provide good cause why they should need the names and addresses of the jurors. For instance, there are four amicus briefs in this case, three on Mr. Hill's side. Any of those parties could have filed a motion like what happened in Press Enterprise and all the various cases that have been cited throughout the briefs. No motion was filed in this case. The court had no opportunity to correct any error if indeed this impacted on Mr. Hill's rights. There's nothing from the record that shows that in any way he was not given an impartial panel. Mr. Hill did not exhaust his peremptory challenges and was given very wide voir dire, extensive voir dire. Got to learn whether any of the long black cars lived near the scene of the crime. Certainly that was an important fact. That particular question was asked.
The counsel is, he has a persuasive argument as to why this did not prejudice this defendant. But you've appealed here. You're asking us to write, and if we go your way, we bless this practice and therefore encourage other courts to do the same.
Well, not necessarily. This court has two options. One of the options is to say that this was a Chapman harmless error, but that the courts should not do this procedure in the future. So that's the way to get around the problem that you're suggesting.
Are you encouraging us to go that way?
That's an interesting question. As a trial lawyer, at least someone who likes to think he's a trial lawyer, I would rather know the names of the jurors. But I also do not think that it's so clearly against the inherent power of a trial court. I argue that this may well be the way of the future, and there is authority throughout your writings that this may well be more comfortable for people. If this encourages juror frankness, openness, and willingness to serve, that this may well be a good thing. But certainly as an attorney, I'd rather know who they are. But as long as I really wouldn't like it if Mr. Hill's attorney knew and I didn't, but as long as it's fair.
Is there some evidence that jurors are unwilling to serve because their names and addresses are known?
There's no evidence in this record. But, and again, this is something that maybe needs to be developed at some on-the-record trial court hearing. But it shouldn't be in too great dispute that it is very difficult to get jurors to serve throughout this country.
But isn't that generally because of other activities going on in their life or the loss of compensation? I guess it would have been my general impression. If people had the time and wasn't a financial hardship on them, they wanted to serve.
Along with privacy, I think the privacy has become very important to people in this day and age, and I think it may, well, in fact, be reassuring to people that they're allowed to render their verdicts and retire and retreat to the anonymity of their lives. And they're not necessarily going to be on 60 Minutes asking them to explain their deliberations.
Under the rule, when do you see the opportunity for counsel to request the court to have a hearing to make the names public? Would that occur? I mean, the lawyer wouldn't know until the jury is impaneled which jurors are going to serve on that jury. So you look at the jury pool. How do you see the rule working?
Well, the rule is very clear that all they need to do is file a motion. It could be a pretrial motion almost at any time. And it's in the body of the rule requesting that whoever is called as a panel, that they're going to become public. So,
I guess my thought is one of the arguments against the rule is that counsel may want to investigate the jurors, as oftentimes happens, I guess, at least in big cases. That wouldn't provide any opportunity for it, would it, for that?
Sure, because the motion could be filed months before the trial, and once the court determines when the trial is going to occur, the court could determine which jurors were going to be called and then provide the names.
Well, just because you have the opportunity to file a motion doesn't mean it's going to be granted.
Correct, but if you can show good cause, then you have that opportunity. That's what's provided for in the rule. And we don't have a single case where anyone ever objected. The court has discretion under the rule to decide whether a party is entitled to know the names of the jurors. And one would think that if this is in fact affected rights, that people would have been filing those motions throughout, wanting to know the names and addresses of the jurors.
So, as I understand your argument, nothing happened that caused this new type of jury to be impaneled. Nothing, jurors weren't threatened or jurors weren't killed or anything of that nature that necessitated this extreme secretiveness of the jury.
Correct, and the important factor.
What brought it about? Someone just thought it was a good idea?
The common pleas court judges, according to the limited record available, after talking to jurors at trials,
did they get complaints from jurors that they were contacted or that something caused them to be apprehensive because their names were open and notorious?
That's not really part of the record, but what is clear is that the trial court felt that the jurors decided that their privacy rights were important.
There are many things that we're asking you today, you have the same answer. That's not part of the record. What is on the record? Nothing?
No. What's on the record is the local court rule on page 20 and 21. I feel uncomfortable answering questions that I don't know the answer to, but that aren't fairly in the record. So the trial court told the jurors that after talking to jurors, in several trials, they gradually decided to do away with the names and addresses.
Oh, there had to be more than them feeling uncomfortable, don't you think? Doesn't the defendant have a right to know who he's being tried by and by name and where they live? Are they in the county or whatever? Why should we say it's okay to be tried by 12 anonymous people that we don't know where they're from or where they live, or who they are, or what they do? What is that?
Well, we do know what they do, because all of them were asked their occupation.
Wonderful, we know what they do. Okay.
And as long as you see their faces and hear the person talk.
Well, you mentioned that someone volunteered that they knew one of the attorneys.
Correct.
What if she didn't volunteer, or he didn't volunteer? How would that come out?
In this particular case, it would have been advantageous to the defendant, but there's no suggestion that just because the person...
The question was, how would that come out if this person didn't volunteer? I know the defense attorney.
Well, that's, in my opinion, that's no different than any other lawyer. I don't know who Mr. Phillips' friends are, so even if we know the names of the jurors, we're not necessarily going to know that they're... defense counsel's friend. I am close to over my time already.
I have another question. I think the problem we're having, Mr. Marks, is that this is a fairly extreme rule. I mean, in terms of compared to rules in the country that have been deemed to be fair and constitutional. And what I guess what at least I'm wondering is what problem is the rule designed to treat? And that's why the absence of a record here is significant. I mean, we have the briefs indicate that it's sort of anecdotal. The judges decided, well, there's some jurors who would prefer to have their names not disclosed. Well, okay, we understand that, but to treat that anecdotal sort of information with a rule, a blanket rule that's not been adopted any place and doesn't seem to be, well, arguably is not constitutional, I guess that's the problem we're having. That's why you're having such a difficult time, because there's no record to tell us why did the court do this, other than just, well, we had a few people that said they'd rather have privacy. Well, that's true of a lot of people today, and I guess with our court system, our justice system, being an open system generally, if we close a part of it, there needs to be some reason for that, and that's the problem I'm having, at least, and I think it's the problem that others are having. It's the reason you're getting these questions.
Sure. The difficulty is that the defendant did not raise that at the trial court level. There is still pending a post-conviction petition motion to stay pending appeal, and at some point, it may or may not be possible to have a record hearing where the judges can be questioned as to why they instituted the policy. But at this point, I can't really say what I know that is not part of the record.
We don't want you to do that. We're just telling you why you're getting the questions you're getting.
You said the judges instituted the policy. Would you tell me how it came about, the rule?
All that we see is just, I think this is what happens.
I want to know what happened, and I'll tell you why.
One day we got the notice with that one piece of paper, Local Rule 1.14, that's attached to the brief, and all parties abided by it.
Did anybody raise or think about looking at Superintendent Rule 5?
I think the appellee in one of their motions has suggested that as a potential problem.
Well, I don't see that in our briefs. What do you think about that? The reason I'm asking you is because maybe what we ought to do is know what Rule 5 says. Nothing in these rules, because we have an appellate rule the same way. The appellate rule 41 says that local rules shall be adopted only after the court gives appropriate notice and opportunity. And I remember in appeals court, we used to adopt rules every now and then. We had to file them with the Supreme Court, and they could not be inconsistent with the Supreme Court rule. Superintendent Rule 5 maybe even is more explicit. Nothing in these rules prevents the adoption of any local rule. Local rules of practice shall not be inconsistent with rules promulgated by the Supreme Court. And then, a local rule of practice shall be adopted only, sounds mandatory, doesn't it? Only after the court or division provides appropriate notice and an opportunity to comment on the proposed rule. If the court determines that there's an immediate need for the rule, then the court may adopt the rule, but shall give prior notice and opportunity for comment, but promptly shall afford notice and opportunity for comment. I can't find anything here that ever happened.
And we don't know because there's an incomplete record.
Well, if it's not in our record, and we know that that rule says that, then why do we even have to go to the merits of this? Why don't we just say this is a local rule that doesn't appear to have been properly adopted and therefore has no effect?
If this defendant had a fair trial, was properly convicted by a jury, and there's nothing in the record to show that the conviction was improper.
So if we convict somebody on a faulty indictment, they still have no recourse because they didn't object to the indictment.
Correct.
So if we convict somebody who clearly didn't do it and five witnesses says they didn't, but we convict them, they have no recourse because they didn't raise it at the time. That's kind of a strange thing that you can violate the rules and say that because you don't raise the rule, you're bound by that.
Well, with your example, you're suggesting that there's actual proof of actual innocence.
Well, there's actual proof here, to me, when I look at the record, there's nothing in there about adoption of that rule.
That's because no one questioned it. That's why it's not in the record.
Well, if we remand it back, then...
then we'll be able to provide a record.
Okay, and if, in fact, this rule has not been promulgated like it should have been, then you recognize you start over?
No, because the Constitution guarantees a fair trial, not a perfect trial. And if a common pleas court adopts a rule improperly, that seems unfair to the jury that sat and decided this case.
Okay, I got it.
Throw out the conviction.
Your strongest argument is waiver, is it not?
Waiver along with general fairness.
Thank you, Mr. Marks. Mr. Phillips.
Good morning, Your Honor. With co-counsel Cheryl Wright and Tim Hoover, I am privileged to be here before you. The problems that were identified by Your Honors are some of, but not all of, the problems that are inherent in the rule, such as the rule we're talking about here, which was in fact a secret rule.
But counsel, even if there were no rule, and a trial judge without a rule decided to implement this procedure in this particular trial, we'd be dealing with the same issue: a trial judge saying we're going to redact the names and addresses of the jurors for this trial. So the rule aside, you know, we have a trial and an individual defendant who was tried under these circumstances. The Court of Appeals determined that this was structural error and that plain error would not suffice. If I read the Fifth District Court of Appeals decision correctly, they said if the defendant were raising this on plain error, using the test about outcome determinative, plain error wouldn't suffice. And the next step for the Court of Appeals was to say, but we find this to be structural error.
I would suggest to you that that wasn't the process or the order in which the court addressed the issue. But you're right. But the fact of the matter is that because of the nature of this error, you don't get the structural, the plain error or harmless error. This is structural error, which this court and the Supreme Court have held.
Well, I realize that's what I'm asking. So we know that it must be, or it is at least decided that it's structural error. And structural error, we know, has to be based on a constitutional violation. And the typical things that have been held to be structural error is, among them are, you know, denial of the right of self-representation, a total lack of right to counsel, not a public trial. And it seems that the argument of the defendant here is that it is the failure to the public trial right is the constitutional right that we're hanging our hat on.
That's one of them.
Explain that one, though. If that's one of them, what's the other one?
Presumption of innocence.
How is that? I guess I need you to be more direct in how those are implicated.
The presumption of innocence. A jury holds your identity is not going to be known.
Yeah.
The clear implication is there's something wrong here.
Okay.
Especially,
well, that,
by the way, in this case, where curiously the state didn't provide you with the full comment by the court, they left out the last sentence. The last word to these juries was, I'll tell you about that later. And that was the last thing that the jury heard about why this rule was in place. There was no record discussion of why this rule was in place. In point of fact, they're left with this pregnant thing.
We'd have to surmise something quite a bit, actually, about that to say that's constitutional. The denial of the presumption of innocence would have to be based on implication, somebody, you know, a pregnant implication. How about the public trial? That's where I'm focused.
Okay.
I'm trying to sort out how the trial is public, as far as I can tell. It was in a public courtroom. Everything. What wasn't public is limited to names and addresses of the jurors. Does that amount to denial of a public trial? I'm having a little bit of trouble with transforming the names and addresses into the utter denial of a public trial.
Your Honor, you have a public trial, but parts of the trial are not public.
Well, the parts of the trial, tell me what parts of the trial weren't public.
as to the public, if we're talking about the public's right to know, about which the unique I spoke, the jury records were not public. As we sit here today...
So we'd have to say that's what part of the trial, you know, it wasn't the voir dire, it wasn't the cross-exam of the defendant, it was...
Although the voir dire was limited.
That's what I wanted to ask you. I was waiting until these questions stopped. Do the judges limit your voir dire, or are you able to ask any questions?
It's like the old model A. You can have any color you want as long as you want black. You can ask any question you want
all right. But you can ask any other question. For example, there are cases where perhaps nationality are important, that you would like to know the nationality of a prospective juror. Are you permitted to ask such questions?
The record doesn't reflect that, but presumably you are.
It would probably be dependent upon the particular judge that you were trying the case in front of.
And so, whether the lawyer wants to take the risk of offending the entire panel by asking.
Absolutely.
The question that I would ask, could you imagine being asked to ratify a policy that said we're going to have 12 jurors and they're all going to wear bags over their heads? Can you imagine that? Nobody would even suggest that.
No, because you would want to be able to assess their demeanor.
And their race.
Well, which isn't prohibited by the name. The absence of a name, is it?
Ethnicity, what Justice Resnick was just talking about, I have to tell you that if I were a defendant, there are certain racial or ethnic backgrounds I'd be looking for, just because that's who I am and what I'm interested in. My lawyer might bring to me, in this community, especially Lancaster, which is a very small community, it might be incredibly relevant to know whether they live on the west side or on the east side. No one would suggest it, not knowing that somebody lives in Upper Arlington.
Now, do we know they couldn't ask whether you live on the east side or the west side?
We don't know, except that we can't ask addresses.
Or we didn't even tell the court we want names and addresses.
There is nothing on the record in respect to a request. However, and the point that I wanted to make, there is nothing on the record in this case about the rule. And that's the small difficulty that's been left out here. Mr. Marks, at the Court of Appeals, admitted he didn't know about the rule. We made multiple requests during the pendency of this case for the rule. The first time this record reflects the existence of a real written rule with this ability to object, this burden shifting, is in the brief in this court.
Did you ever check to see if it was filed with the Supreme Court in accordance with the rule? Was it filed?
Incredibly, it was. And that is the only place that somebody presumably could go to find the existence of this rule. Because if you went to the clerk of the Fairfield County Court of Common Pleas and asked for the Common Pleas local rules, they don't send it to you.
Do you recall what date it was filed with the Supreme Court?
I think we have it in our motion to strike. And for that reason, by the way, we filed a motion to strike, because it isn't in the record. There is nothing in the record, apropos of questions asked, as to why they did this, other than a kind of anecdotal comment by the judge to the jury, you know, we're kind of doing this.
Well, whose obligation would it be? Wouldn't it be the defendant's obligation, because it's the defendant raising this as an error? Not at trial, but at the appellate level, to produce that was in the record, or to make it a part of the record.
Your Honor, frankly, we didn't know it existed. We made repeated requests, and indeed, as I say, when the Court of Appeals asked about a written rule, Mr. Marks said he was unaware of it.
Well, it's designated as Local Rule Court 1.14, jury questionnaires, and then 1.14 for comment. What is it not, if you look at the local rules published by, does the court publish local rules?
They do.
I assume they do. So it's in the local rules.
This was done by entry. That entry was never incorporated into the local rules.
It says the amendment to said local rules is effective immediately. So you're saying that it didn't catch up with the printed copy of the local rules, I guess.
It didn't throughout the Court of Appeals proceeding, because as I say, we have lawyers calling saying where the local rules.
You said it's not even filed there.
No, it apparently is filed here, Your Honor.
Yeah, I understand that.
We raised the issue of the rule you made reference to in our appellate.
I understand that, too. But you're saying that you checked there and it is not filed there?
No, no.
The same question kind of the chief is asking.
There is an entry.
Okay, I'm talking about the rule. I'm talking about the rule. Well, 5A3 says upon adoption, the court or division shall file a local rule of practice with its clerk and the clerk of the Supreme Court. So what they're saying is they filed the JE, and that's enough, even though it is not part of the codified rules.
Apparently, that's what they're saying. What we're saying is, and in truth, focusing on the administrative portion of this rule and whether it's properly filed is an appropriate inquiry, but the more appropriate inquiry, I would suggest to the court, is just what exactly is going on down there. The burden is being shifted from the state of Ohio to provide a fair trial to the defendant.
Well, it appears to me that the defense counsel didn't feel there was anything wrong with this.
The defense counsel did not object.
He didn't do
to
anything.
This or a plethora of other things, all of which are subjects to various other assignments of error that were never dealt with at the Court of Appeals, there, as a result of which there's an IAC assignment as well. But no, there was no objection. But the cases seem pretty clear that in cases of structural error, there needs to be none because there is a presumption of prejudice.
Counsel, walk us through how this concept is introduced to the jury by the court.
Well, as best
what's the record reflects, what's it reflect?
At the initial portion of when the criminal verdict 12 are impaneled, the judge in this case, I don't know what they do in other cases, but they did in most cases, but in this case, he makes a comment, you know, we're trying to protect your privacy. We've been doing this slowly. He doesn't say it has nothing to do with the defendants. Right? He says nothing about the defendant, good or bad, and then in this case, he makes this pregnant comment. And then just stops.
Does it explain that this is a matter of course in all trials?
Yes.
Fairfield County?
Yes.
Criminal and civil?
Yes.
Is there a letter? Is that reflected in the to the jurors? They get some initial contact from the court telling them they're going to be jurors.
As best the record reflects, their first notice of what's going to happen is when they're sitting in the box.
So until they come to the courthouse, they don't know that they're
That's correct.
Now, could you address, the answer just strictly structural error. If we were not persuaded that this is structural error, do we still have the latitude to do what the prosecutor has suggested, find as to your client, there's no harm, there's no objection, the conviction stands, but still indicate that we can this is a rule that is inappropriate for use in Ohio.
No. This, if we're not structural error, is so painfully, clearly plain error, not subject to an objection, that this is such a deviation from the norm, from what we all know to be the jury system.
Okay, so it's plain.
It is abundantly plain error, but in this case it is so much more gross than you can with that plain error.
When you say it's plain error, though, you would have to say that it was outcome determinative, that because the names and addresses weren't known, the result of the trial would have been different.
Well, Your Honor, it's interesting because you asked that question earlier. The whole reason why structural error...
We were talking about plain error.
I understand, but the whole reason that structural error is the way it is,
yes,
that there is no showing of prejudice necessary, is because structural errors...
I understand that completely.
Errors, you can't prove prejudice.
Right, and that's why we went off structural error, Justice Pfeiffer did, and asked you if we didn't have structural, what about plain? And you said, well, you sure as heck have plain. I'm saying, I don't know that you do.
But I guess what I'm saying to you is, apropos of that, And I understand you want us to stick to plain error, but what I'm saying...
No, I don't. I'm saying when you do get to plain error, I'm afraid you're out of luck, but structural's different.
I would suggest to you that that's not true anyway, because there is a presumption of irregularity. There is a presumption that if you are limited to knowing the names and the addresses of jurors, that you cannot conduct a fair...
Structural.
Even plain. Frankly, this is not a plain error case. This is so fundamental to the concept of a trial.
If we don't buy structural error and go to plain error, you don't have to object.
That's correct. All right.
But you do have to show what?
You have to show that it would have affected the outcome determined.
Take your best shot on that.
My best shot on that is very difficult because of the nature of structural error. You don't know. But my best shot is you don't even know who the jurors are or would have been. I can tell you that if I know the names, they didn't use all their peremptory challenges, Your Honor. Now, you can say, well, obviously that means it wasn't a big deal. Or you can say there was no place to go because you couldn't ask, you couldn't find out, for example, that four of the people on the jury had the same name. That would say, you couldn't find out five of them lived within two blocks of each other.
You don't know a lot, but what you do know is what the defendant did.
Are you referring to what he did in the trial?
Yeah. No. It's crime.
Well, I would suggest to you that whether and to what extent he committed any crime is subject to whether and to what extent the state proved it. We have significant...
I'm talking about outcome determinative.
I'm sorry?
I'm talking about outcome determinative. That's got to be your burden if we go to plain error, and it's a pretty substantial body of evidence here.
Well, as we make fairly clear, the state characterizes the evidence in an interesting way. We would characterize the evidence very differently. And for example, if you cut the hearsay out of this case, which, by the way, is laced through the statement of facts in the briefing in this court, if you cut out comments by four witnesses, for example, this is just one of a litany of them, four witnesses testified that the victim told them, hey, if I turn up dead, the defendant did it. And that was allowed in, apparently, as a dying declaration, despite the fact that the person had been injured, the person wasn't in the fear of death. You know, I mean, the only things this jury heard were hearsay. There was no forensic evidence whatsoever, except forensic evidence that was in favor of the defendant. We had somebody testify in this case, despite the fact that the defendant was a .14 7 hours after he was arrested. We had somebody getting around that. The state's witness said, well, being drunk might improve your aim. I mean, I would suggest to you this, quote, overwhelming evidence of guilt is by no means overwhelming. Is there some circumstantial evidence? Sure. But overwhelming evidence of guilt? We had a witness there were no eyewitnesses. We had a witness who said, gee, I thought it looked like the defendant. She couldn't identify the defendant in the trial. Her father said, I know the defendant. I didn't recognize him. These are things, of course, left out.
Mr. Phillips, your light is on, but let me ask you a question about the... You argued that the rule should not be an absolute rule because, and then you gave certain various reasons, and one of them was presumption of innocence. What happens to the presumption of innocence in the cases, particularly in the federal courts, where they do say that you can make the jurors' names anonymous? What happens to the presumption, the cases where there really is some danger to the, or perceived danger to the jurors? What happens to the presumption of innocence there?
It depends.
There's balancing, isn't there?
I would suggest to you that it depends what the courts seem to require and what the courts have done in the Scarfo case, in the Barnes case, in the Angulo case, in the Gotti case. Is there something with people? These are all cases where this was ratified after a hearing, after findings, none of which were done here. One of the standards is you must make a neutral statement to the jury, one that will not create a question about the presumption of innocence. And the judges then do a good job, certainly enough that on appeal, the courts don't reverse them, of making a statement about we're going to use
numbers, or we're not going to use your names. It has nothing to do with this defendant, something that wasn't said in this case. Instead, the court let in that he was convicted of escape earlier. So now, I'm a juror, and I'm thinking, oh, he's going to tell us something later. The only thing I hear later is he was convicted of escape. So courts are, it's interesting, the Edwards case, which has just decided the governor of Louisiana went through this thing, and there are findings by the trial court that convicted him, actually. Now we know he was convicted. It's a long decision, and it discusses in very specific detail what it's going to say to the juror. And that's the kind of thing that, this is something that requires somebody.
In addition, generally, aren't the names made available in those cases to the to the attorneys, but the attorneys just cannot disclose them?
Sure. That's my
experience. Because I have never heard of a situation where jurors' names are kept secret from the attorneys.
There are a few cases where it's kept secret from the press after a hearing. None. In the history of American or English jurisprudence, there is not a single case that has upheld doing what was done here. No hearing, no finding, no nothing, just unilaterally done. As we sit here today, if you go to the clerk of courts in Fairfield County, and you want to know why Clifford Hill is in prison for the rest of his life, you will find an entry that's whited out. No signatures, no names. There is no way to know who personified this verdict.
You've used your time, Mr. Willis.
Thank you.
Mr. Marks, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Clear.
You don't have to.
Judge did make a neutral statement on page 20 and 21. 38 points of evidence were cited in the reply brief, none of which contained hearsay. Ben never wants to talk about the overwhelming evidence. The Court of Appeals said no plain error. Structural error requires the finding that there was an uneven playing field. All the cases cited in these federal cases, the defendants objected to the impanelment of the non-jury, and most of the federal cases upheld the verdict. Clearly not structural error. There was unlimited voir dire, and neither counsel was prohibited from asking a single question.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.